From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 1 week after a massive typhoon devastated large areas of the Philippines, the World Health Organization said that the full extent of the disaster is becoming increasingly clear. WHO reported that humanitarian hubs have been established in at least 7 of the hardest hit provinces and that aid is beginning to reach people in need. However, the organization said the scope of the disaster could be larger, as approximately 20 smaller islands and remote communities that may have been impacted by the storm have not yet been scoped for damage. Gregory Hartle is WHO's spokesperson in Geneva.
The major concerns for us a week after the typhoon hit is injury management, because there is a substantial group of people that we are concerned about who have been injured and might not yet have been seen to. And at this point, if their injuries cannot be addressed, there is the chance that they will unfortunately succumb rather than survive.
The organization estimates that there are more than 200,000 pregnant women and 130,000 breastfeeding women in the affected areas who need services. Meanwhile, supplies of some basic necessities are already running low. We have this report from UN Radio.
As United Nations agencies scale up their relief efforts in typhoon-hit regions of the Philippines, a major fuel shortage is hampering efforts to reach millions of affected people with humanitarian aid. UN agencies say although aid is now reaching the country, moving it to those in need is taking longer than expected due to a lack of fuel and the large amount of debris blocking roads. United Nations Children's Fund UNICEF says it has enough fuel to pump clean water in the Tacloban area for 2 days, while the UN World Food Programme says truckloads of relief supplies are stuck at Tacloban Airport and other service centres due to lack of fuel. Elizabeth Bales is WFP spokesperson in Geneva.
Fuel will run out in a few days, but as WFP is contracting a fleet of trucks and WFP is now investigating options to secure fuel, we need fuel storage, fuel bladders, and we will do it as the head of the logistic cluster together, of course, with the Philippine authorities. On Thursday, we distributed high energy biscuit to 5,000 people at the Tacloban Airport itself. Deliveries of biscuits to the affected communities are due to start today. At the end of Thursday, over 34,000 family food packs have been distributed in Leyte province. Family food packs contain WFP rice ration, 3 kilos, and have reached 170,000 beneficiaries.
The number of people affected by Typhoon Haiyan has risen to 11.8 million, with over 920,000 people displaced as more areas become accessible. The $301 million United Nations appeal for Philippines has so far received $50 million. Patrick Maigua, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
More than 100 business operators have been arrested in a crackdown by the Venezuelan government on allegations of price gouging. President Nicolas Maduro described the group as barbaric capitalist parasites. The government is in the process of preparing anti-gouging legislation that would limit businesses' profits to between 15 and 30% of income. Government officials say that unscrupulous companies have jacked up prices of electronics and a number of other consumer goods and durables more than 1,000% over the past year. Despite the inflation, the poverty rate in the country, according to the World Bank, dropped by 20% in Venezuela last year, the largest decline in poverty in the hemisphere for 2012. Yesterday, the Venezuelan National Assembly approved legislation giving the Venezuelan president greater authority to deal directly with a variety of economic issues. We'll have more on that later in the program when we speak with our reporter in Managua, Tony Solo, as well as a report on an outbreak of dengue fever that is threatening people across Central America. From Russia, the Russian news agency RIA Novosti reports that Moscow police have filed criminal charges against alleged performance artist Pyotr Pavlensky. He was charged with hooliganism after he nailed his genital sack to the cobblestones in Moscow's Red Square. He called the act, quote, a metaphor of apathy, political indifference, and fatalism in Russian society, closed quote. If convicted, Pavlensky could face a fine, mandatory public service, or up to 15 days in jail. Moscow's Tverskoy District Court earlier remanded his case to the police after a procedural error. Prosecutors announced earlier today that they charged Theodore P. Wafer with second-degree murder and manslaughter in the death of Renisha McBride early on November 2nd in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. The 19-year-old McBride was killed by a shotgun blast to the face on Wafer's front porch. Wafer reportedly told police he thought McBride was trying to break into his house, but according to a press release from the Wayne County prosecutor, Kim Worthy, there were no signs of forced entry at the home. Worthy previously brought a successful prosecution in a case against two white Detroit police officers for the 1992 beating death of a black motorist, Malisa Green. She also pursued criminal charges in 2008 against Kwame Kilpatrick, then the mayor of Detroit, who was eventually convicted of federal crimes. It's Friday, and that means we'll be speaking with our correspondent in Managua, Nicaragua, Tony Solo, about things south of El Rio Grande. Tony, welcome.
Hi, Don. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Things are pretty good down here. I mean, we're still in the middle of the dengue epidemic, and we had in the barrio next door to us, somebody nearly died. They were the local health service managed to save his life. He went into shock as a result of the dengue. Apparently what the dengue does is the strains that are currently affecting the Central American region attack the organism in such a way as to lower the blood pressure quite abruptly and dramatically.
Oh.
And if somebody's immune system isn't in great shape, or if they're, you know, they're for some reason vulnerable, they can very easily die. So, and that's what happened to this guy, but he was saved by the local health service, which is good news.
Yeah.
But it just means that we've got to be on the alert still for another 2 or 3 weeks.
That means it's in your neighborhood too, right? Maybe. I mean, he might have got it while he was out running around, but
yeah.
Ouch.
Who knows? Just never know. I mean, but the nationwide campaign is very impressive. I mean, the government has mobilized not just the health service, but all kinds of other actors in Nicaraguan society. For example, university students and functionaries in public offices, like, for example, the tax office. We've got a friend who works in the tax office, and one day a week she and her colleagues are sent out to do health promotion work in the barrios as part of the dengue campaign.
Do you see any evidence of, like, the World Health Organization or, UN or any of that stuff?
Well, in the Pan American Health Organization, and I think that's part of the UN structure, is working very closely with all the regional governments trying to prevent the epidemic from completely getting out of control. And they seem to be having some success. And here in Nicaragua so far, we've had 18 deaths this year as a result of the dengue outbreak.
Mm.
But somewhat less than other countries. I think Guatemala and Honduras, unfortunately, have had more fatalities. And the curious thing is that while Costa Rica's had many times more cases of dengue, they've had fewer fatalities than anybody. And they're, you know, just one of the anomalies that's thrown up in the region by the outbreak. So yeah, and the international health institutions seem to be working very effectively with national governments.
Good. That's a good thing. You know, it's amazing. I remember growing up, malaria was the big, still is, a big mosquito-borne disease. And I remember in the 60s and early 70s, the various international agencies and the medical profession here were talking about, you know, doing away with malaria globally. And instead, here we are, now 30, 40 years later, and we have a multiplicity of mosquito-borne diseases. I think I've told you before, here in the Northeast and almost the entire eastern coast of the U.S., as a matter of fact, we've had to deal with the West Nile virus over the last, five, six, 7 years.
Yeah, it just goes to show how vulnerable we are to our natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the only species on the planet.
That's right. And some of them like to eat us.
Right.
So what's going on south of El Rio Grande in the last week or so? I know there's been some activity. You have elections in Chile and somewhere else.
In Honduras. There are elections coming up in Honduras on, I think it's November the 26th. Mm. November the 24th, that's a Sunday, yeah. Mm. It's November the 24th. And I think the elections in Chile are this Sunday.
That's right, this Sunday, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, and those two elections, and of course the Colombian peace negotiations continue to make excruciatingly slow progress, but at least they're happening, which is, something very, very positive for the region.
Mm.
And the next door to Colombia in Venezuela, Venezuelan government led by President Nicolas Maduro is engaged in what some people are interpreting as an almost life or death struggle against economic sabotage that the country's right wing have been promoting, apparently with the active support of the United States government.
Yeah, so let's start with Venezuela, because it's an interesting contrast to what's been going on in the United States. Since the collapse of the economic system, or in any event, the crash and burn that took place in 2008-2009, there has been a lot of finger-pointing at the banks, the financial system, the financial sector. That's where the blame lies, and substantial evidence of that fact. And yet, that's where all the money went, was, to revive that sector, as opposed to the usual Keynesian solution to a recession, which is to put money in the hands of consumers. And so even now, we had Elizabeth Warren, a freshman senator from Massachusetts, the other day saying, it's time to deal with holding that whole sector accountable. And yet it hasn't happened. We're in the second term of Barack Obama, who was elected to deal with it. And we have instead Maduro cracking down on speculation, usury, and financial chicanery there from essentially that same sector.
Yeah, and it's difficult to draw a comparison between Venezuela over the last 10, 15 years, since 1998, when President Hugo Chavez took office, and the United States during the same period, because they've had diametrically opposite policies, haven't they? I mean, in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and his colleagues worked tirelessly to reduce poverty, to democratize the country, in particular to democratize the economy. I know often when people talk about democracy, they seem to try and limit that concept to the political sphere and emphasize civil and political rights. But as one of the things that has made Venezuela so successful in its poverty reduction policies is that they prioritized not just democracy in its civil and political rights aspect, but also in its social and economic and cultural rights aspect. And so over the last few years, I was reading a piece in VenezuelaAnalysis.com, which is an excellent website for English speaking people about Venezuela. There was a piece there, and I think it was Mark Weisbrot. It was originally published in The Guardian, my bête noire. But an excellent piece by the economist Mike Weisbrot, who I think works with Dean Baker at the the Center for Economic and Policy Research, something like that. I think they're a North American outfit. So Weisbrot was pointing out that last year the World Bank recorded that Venezuela achieved a 20% reduction in poverty. And Weisbrot pointed out that in macroeconomic terms, all the macroeconomic indicators in terms of reserves and debt in relation to gross domestic product and all that kind of macroeconomic stuff that kind of makes my head spin. And he pointed out that all those indicators were excellent in comparison with the United States or other countries in Western Europe.
Right.
And he also pointed out that in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms, ordinary people in Venezuela had seen an increase in their personal income, averaging something like 2.7% a year.
Right.
Which is in very sharp contrast to the situation in the United States, where people's real incomes, adjusted for inflation, are either stagnant or in decline. It's not difficult to imagine what the United States would be like if it had applied similar kinds of policies to Venezuela. Ordinary people would be much better off in all kinds of ways.
Yep.
You know, so it seems to me that one of the, and in fact Weisbrot in his article, actually he ends his article saying, asking fellow economic writers in the mainstream corporate media why they don't publish the macroeconomic facts about Venezuela's poverty reduction and so forth.
Yep. Yeah, he actually refers them to the website of the World Bank to look at the actual data.
He asks them to make the arduous cyber journey.
Right, with a click.
With a click to the World Bank website. Yeah, and that's a very relevant question, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it's a question that's not just relevant to Venezuela, it's relevant to almost all foreign affairs coverage in North America and Western Europe.
Well, you know, here in the United States, you have a condition where they've just cut back on November 1st food stamps, for example, not because there's been any supporting change in the economic environment that would allow people to, you know, to continue to eat without that money, but because a clock went off in some arbitrary funding scheme that was put together by Congress and the Obama administration. The public policy discussion of that doesn't range to any kind of change that would be founded on people having a right to eat and you know, the kinds of public policy items that are at the basis of the organization of the Venezuelan economy. And so if you were to refer to what's going on in Venezuela, of course, you might have to look at vectors between policy in Venezuela and policy in the United States. Of course, how does that factor into a discussion that takes place between the Democrats and Republicans that doesn't start with people have the right to eat, we have the means to feed them, they will be fed?
Yeah, and that's all that's extremely apposite. But another angle that people might use is to come at the comparison between the United States and Venezuela in terms of the passionate support that economists in the United States have for the market economy. And if you look at Venezuela, what they found in Venezuela is that unrestrained capitalism has led to incredible levels of price gouging that have deeply affected the levels of inflation in Venezuela. For example, something like 100 people are now in detention on charges of price gouging. And what are we talking about? We're talking about fridges, for example, being on sale for something like three times their list price.
The fridges, meaning refrigerators?
Yeah, refrigerators.
Right. Yeah.
And a whole range of consumer items and even textiles were having 2,000% price markups. And that, of course, is a fundamental component of Venezuela's persistent problem with price inflation. So, which in comparison to other countries in Latin America is excessively high. So, you know, where does that leave the free market? And of course, there's no such thing as a free market. There are only well-regulated markets and less well-regulated markets,
right,
or as in the case of the United States financial system, practically unregulated markets. You know,
right.
When one looks at the the way the financial sector, the banking sector, and the shadow banking sector, which are inseparable at this point, and that the shadow banking sector has been allowed to flourish and turn banks basically into little more than financial intermediaries for big finance.
Yep.
Rather than the traditional conventional role of a bank, which is to be the intermediary between depositors and investors.
You know, there's this aspect to the inflation that that you're referring to in some in prices of goods and others, and also in terms of the black market dollar rate that go to something referred to as the strategic plan Venezuela, that was, according to this article I'm looking at, that you forwarded to me, prepared in Washington, Colombia, and the Venezuelan opposition last June, aside from calling for violence, specifically outlined tactics to destroy the Venezuelan economy. And it says that the foundation for the current attack is the black market dollar, which is an illegal currency exchange engineered to devalue the currency in Venezuela, the bolivar. The black market dollar started at 12.6 bolivars to the dollar a year ago, on the day after Chavez was reelected in October of 2012. After Maduro beat Radonsky in April of this year, it shot up to 26, and now it's at 60.
Right. Yeah, so and of course the government can control that. You know, if they chose to issue more dollars,
right,
they'd be able to control the kind of secondary market that's developed in foreign exchange in Venezuela, in particular in relation to the dollar.
Right.
But that issue is an issue for all revolutionary governments that are targeted by the United States in an area which is effectively a dollar zone.
Right.
The Latin America and the Caribbean. And it's been a huge problem for Cuba. It was a huge problem for Nicaragua during the years of the Sandinista revolution in the 1980s. And now again, it's a big problem for a revolutionary process in Venezuela. So the use of the dominance for the purchase of goods internationally, the use of the dollar to disrupt that in a country like Venezuela has a long history, and of course that's one of the reasons why the ALBA countries are so determined to establish a financial architecture that liberates them from dependence on the dollar, and that there are various ways that they're doing that, and we've discussed that in past programs.
Right, including the proto-currency they're using. I'm interested I wonder if, are the transactions that take place among the regional construct countries there subject to this kind of manipulation when they're using either trading, you know, directly, or using this proto currency that they're working with now?
Well, I don't think so. I'm by no means a trade expert, but that mechanism is run by the central banks of the countries concerned, and they coordinate extremely closely. They have to, for the thing to work in the first place.
Right.
And the way it works is that, for example, say Ecuador wants to sell something to Bolivia and doesn't want to use dollars. They work through their country's central banks and the Sucre system, as it's called.
Yes.
And they get a price for their goods in terms of their national currency, and the Bolivians buy it in the Bolivian national currency. I've forgotten what the currency is in Bolivia. And so the seller gets paid in their national currency, and the buyer pays for it in their national currency at an agreed rate.
Right.
So there's no room for manipulation there, because it's all controlled by the central bank.
Right.
And the other in Nicaragua's case, a lot of its trade with Venezuela is barter.
Right.
So in exchange for Venezuelan oil, Nicaragua will pay for that oil with increasingly they're exporting the black beans to Venezuela, which is the kind of bean that is used in the Venezuelan national diet, whereas here in Nicaragua, people are used to the red beans. So they're selling hundreds of tons of black beans to Venezuela in exchange for Venezuela's oil, and that way that eliminates any foreign exchange difficulties.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing the variety of tactics that are employed in these various international schemes that the United States plays with in this hemisphere, particularly with the effects of this are felt by the people in these countries. If you can't buy a refrigerator, then you don't have a refrigerator. You know, public policy, health issues that are involved, all kinds of things.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I know, of course, that's part of the relevance of the Chilean election.
Right.
Because in Chile, the progressive candidate, Michelle Bachelet, is almost certain to win. She has something like a 30 or 40 percentage point lead over her nearest rival, the right-wing candidates.
Wow.
And she's been campaigning on an electoral platform of liberalization of certain aspects of the social policy in Chile. On economically, she's talking about being more supportive of trade union rights, of labor rights. But the interesting thing for at an international level is what will be the stance of any new government under Michelle Bachelet with regard to Latin American integration. Right. Is she going to continue the policies of Sebastián Piñera of deepening Chile's commitment to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the latest corporate boondoggle to tie whole countries into corporate-dominated economic arrangements?
Right.
Or is she going to turn more towards working with Mercosur in Latin America, perhaps working with even the ALBA countries?
You know, especially for Chile, that's the economy that they made scream, that led to Pinochet and all of that back in the early 1970s when they essentially murdered President Salvador Allende.
Yeah, and a lot of people are saying that what's happening in Venezuela is an attempt to replay the economic sabotage that was the prelude to the coup, the military coup led by Augusto Pinochet against Salvador Allende.
Right.
So there is some kind of symmetry, as it were, between this. Election. It's the first election in which voting isn't mandatory in Chile, and what's happening in Venezuela. And I think the interest for people outside Chile is what is going to be the Bachelet's government attitude to regional integration in Latin America, and what is going to be its policy on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right. Just going back for a moment to the question of further integration into perhaps even ALBA. I mean, that is the one thing that would insulate Chile and Venezuela further from this kind of manipulation by the United States.
Yeah, and it would. And of course, if one looks back at Michelle Bachelet's role back in, I think it was 2008, 2009, she had to leave office in 2010. And back in those 3 years, and she was very supportive of consolidating UNASUR, and she was very supportive of President Evo Morales when Evo Morales was subject to an attempt by the right-wing opposition to destabilize his government, which was very strongly backed by the United States.
Right.
So a Bachelet government is probably viewed with, not with concern, not with great concern by the United States, but certainly they won't be very sympathetic.
Okay, I want to pick it up there next week. We're out of time, and I'd like to thank you for your time, Tony Solo, our correspondent from Nicaragua. talking about things south of El Rio Grande.
Okay, thanks very much, Don. I hope you have a good week.
Thanks. Same to you. Be well. And that's all the news we have for you right now. From Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.